Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan. Engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can also ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I've also launched a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which is also on iHeartRadio. There I explain my worldview and what I have learned about the mysteries of life in short weekly podcasts. I hope you'll join me there. Everybody wonders about death. Mainstream science tells us we are an accumulation of chemicals, and when we die, we simply disappear. But science ignores a massive amount of data to the contrary. Religion paints a picture of heaven and hell and ensures us that if we follow their all too often self-serving advice, then we'll be fine. But a rational person who looks at all the data will surely come to the conclusion that by far the most likely answer is that an all-loving spiritual realm awaits us at death. In fact, a spiritual realm is our real home. And this physical world is an illusion created to teach us wisdom and enhance our spiritual evolution. Our show today is titled Death Experiences, and our guest is Patricia Pearson. Ms. Pearson is a critically acclaimed independent journalist whose work has appeared in places like the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Daily Beast, and the Daily Telegraph. She recently oversaw the research for a historical documentary on the science of the soul. She is the author of 6 books to include Opening Heaven's Door, which became a finalist for the British Columbia National Book Award. The documentary version of her earlier book, A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine, aired on the CBC in 2012 and won a Rocky Award from the Banff Global Television Festival. She has also won 3 National Magazine Awards and the Arthur Ellis Award for the Best Nonfiction Book of 1998. Patricia Pearson. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thanks, David.
Hey, it's great to have you on. I read your book, The Opening Heaven's Door, and I'm curious, why did you write that book?
Well, it wasn't in my background as a journalist to look at spiritual subjects as such at the time. But what happened was my sister and father died within 9 weeks of each other in 2008. And they were both very unexpected deaths. And the night that my father died, my sister, who was still alive, was awake in her bedroom about 100 miles away, and she suddenly became aware of a presence in the bedroom and hands gently cupping the back of her head, and was suffused with a kind of almost indescribable feeling of joy and peacefulness that she was completely amazed by. She had no idea how to interpret what was happening to her. And this went on for a couple of hours, and then she got out of bed and found out that my father had died. So that was a truly intriguing and amazing experience that my whole family became very interested in. So that sort of started my curiosity about what, in fact, is going on with consciousness. And then as my sister herself began to die, she had cancer. She started to show shifts in consciousness that I didn't understand and had never seen before. And she became extremely radiant and extremely happy. And she was not a happy person in general. She was quite an anxious person. So again, it was something I'd never seen before. And so it set me on this path that ultimately resulted in me researching and writing this book.
Well, you guys before.
Now, you wrote a number of things in your book about the deathbed experience. And in all honesty, that's one area that I had never really spent a lot of time researching. And you clearly did. So I want to talk to you a little bit about it and some of the things you found out. To start with, when you looked into this, did you find that a lot of people had peaceful visions at death?
Yeah, actually, what they've now since my book came out, they've done some research at Hospice Buffalo, where over the course of 18 months, they've found that the patients in hospice, 88% of them are having becoming and reassuring visions and dreams at the end of life. So we now have some sort of quantitative data around this. So essentially, it's not everybody has it, but when people are in clear consciousness toward the end of their life, they do tend to have visions that are slightly different than hallucinations. They'll see deceased people in the room. They'll feel reassured by their presence, or they'll dream about them, or they'll dream about themselves going on some kind of journey. And it becomes very practical for them. So it's like, I need my shoes, I need my car keys, I have to take the bus. They actually are beginning to picture themselves not going into an abyss of nothing, but actually going on some kind of journey.
Do they think they're going home?
They often make references to going home. And it's so interesting and important to understand that this is a very common use of language at the end of life, because, for instance, this past winter, my aunt died, and indeed, she said to my uncle, I want to go home. And he, like many people, was confused by that statement because she was in a hospital setting. And so, he was saying to her, I'm sorry, you can't go home. We have to stay in the hospital. But it was so clear to me at this point that that's not what she was saying to him. She was saying, I'm ready to die.
Yeah. Do many people that are close to death get visits from other deceased, from deceased beings?
Yeah, that's a pretty high percentage. And significantly, it will tend to be deceased people and not living people. So it's not like they're hallucinating kind of random people around them. And in some cases, they actually will have a vision of somebody that they don't realize has died. So for example, if three people in a family are in a car accident and one of them has died and the other one is in the ICU, but hasn't been told that person has died, but they will see them as a vision at the end of their bed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do many of these people that are dying realize how close to death they are?
Yeah, that's another thing that's really fascinating, because there's no medical reason for this, but people will have a quite specific sense of when they're going to go. And actually, I was talking to hospice nurses recently about, they wanted people to be reassured by the fact that approximately half of their patients will wait until all of the family members are out of the room to die. So people often feel very badly about the fact that, oh my God, I went down the hall to make a phone call and she died and she was alone. But actually, that's a choice that's being made by people who are dying.
So they prefer people not being in the room, or they prefer people being in the room? Or
depending,
does it vary?
It varies. So it depends on their personality. But essentially, they're making a choice there. So again, it's a mystery, because it's not correlated with a medical prognosis. And that was true with my sister, for example. She was never given a prognosis when she went into palliative care. Nobody ever said to her, you have 3 weeks to live or 6 months to live or nothing like that. She became very clear about when she was going. And in fact, she woke up one morning and looked at her boyfriend in frustration and said, why am I still here? I don't know how to leave.
And she was referring to dying, I assume.
Yeah, and she died within about 48 hours of that statement.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So does our consciousness change? How does our consciousness change when we get near death?
Well, I've thought a lot about this in the aftermath of working on this book, and clearly there's no clear answer, but there's lots of sort of theories about what's going on. And it seems to me, when you look at all the evidence, that there's a kind of disentangling of consciousness from the body structure. So it's almost as if you think of consciousness as a river, and then, you know, let's say the river has to flow through a metal sewer grate. And that metal sewer grate is the infrastructure of our brain. So our brain is constructed to sort of filter consciousness. And as we come toward the end of life and those brain structures, biological structures begin to break down, it's almost as if consciousness begins to kind of flow more freely. And so then people become more, they almost have enhanced attunement at the end of life, which is really interesting to watch. And so it's almost as if their consciousness is expanding.
And it's getting out of the body.
Yeah, it's getting out of the body.
Yeah. You know, hospice, you mentioned hospice a few minutes ago. That should be a really good place to study this because, you know, one, people used to die in their home and then they're scattered all around and you're involved with people that are emotionally involved with it. And it's pretty hard to gather information. And even in hospitals, I mean, let's face it, the nurses have a horrendous amount of things to do at any one time. So it's pretty hard for them to, you know, to spend a lot of time documenting what happens. But a hospice is a place that I would think that, you know, people could start understanding this and start doing research in this area.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that's where you're getting most cutting edge research now is coming out of hospice in the United States and also in the United Kingdom. And, you know, it's what's important about that, I think, is that a lot of our understanding at the moment about spirituality is coming from years and years and years of heavily medicalized death. So this is really the first time since the 19th century that we have started to have environments in which we can begin to observe, you know, what may be the spiritual aspects of dying. So it's kind of a new era in reminding ourselves of what our ancestors might have observed and known.
Yeah, that's a good point because we do have a tendency to give people a lot of medicine and clearly they're not themselves and they kind of change as an effect of the medicine. You know, we're trying to get rid of their pain, which I certainly can see and support. But it also changes what's going on with them, at least as far as we can see it.
Yeah, that's right. And also the people, by the way, who have these end-of-life visions are not the same as the people who are heavily medicated. So actually, the more drugs they're on, the less likely they are to have these visions. So sometimes when I talk about this research, people say, oh, well, that must be hallucinations as a result of the drugs. But it's not. It's a separate phenomenon.
Yeah. You mentioned in your book, Second Sight. What's a Second Sight?
Second Sight is a Scottish, sort of folklore term. And what the Scots mean by that is, seeing a person, who's died. So seeing them as a second, I forget exactly how the phrasing goes, but essentially what they mean is that at the moment that somebody dies, they might see them walking along the road. So they become aware of death at a distance. And that's actually what they mean by second sight. They don't mean being psychic. They mean becoming aware of somebody's death at a distance.
Does it happen just as the person dies, or is it something that might happen within a week or two of it?
Generally speaking, it happens within sort of 48 hours or 24 hours. But yeah, a version of that is also what we in North America call grief hallucinations, which is seeing somebody, you know, it can be 6 weeks later, it can be a year later that you see or sense or hear a person who has died. And there's no psychiatric research on grief hallucinations. We don't really understand what's going on with that. We've just decided to call it hallucinations.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's the spirit of the person that's seeing it actually sensing or experiencing that being that is there, or do you think it's all taking place in their mind?
I don't know. I mean, the argument could go either way, I think. it's certainly been suggested that what's going on is that you, on some level, become aware of the death of somebody important to you, and then you project an image the way that, for instance, let's say you're sleeping and your alarm clock goes off, but in your sleeping brain, you reinterpret that as a clock bell or, you know, as some other sound. So it's like you're getting a real signal, a real awareness is there. And then potentially you're projecting an image to fit that awareness. I mean, that's one theory. It's who knows?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomena. And I know people that it's happened to. It hasn't happened to me personally, but I do know people that it has happened to it. And they'll tell you that, you know, that it's very real. You know, they look out the door and they, you know, they see the person cutting the grass that they've cut for years, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. It's so real that sometimes people will chase the person down the street. And particularly in cases where they have no idea that that person has died. So they just think that they've seen the
somebody.
Person.
Yeah. It's
like, why aren't you talking to me? Where are you going?
Yeah. Tell me about the third man phenomena. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when my sister had that sense of presence the night that my father died, I got interested in looking at the research on what that meant. What is a sense presence? And what I came across was a whole body of information about what happens to explorers and mountain climbers and solo sea journeyers and people in extreme physical environments. And they have a whole term for it, which is called the third man. And it comes out of initially the expedition of Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton, in the Antarctic, where he and two of his men were crossing the Antarctic. And their ships had been lost, and they all became aware of a third man walking beside them who wasn't actually there. But so in all of these cases, when they're in these extreme environments, they become aware of a presence that accompanies them until they're out of danger. So the presence is there until the situation resolves, and then the presence leaves. You could arguably call it a guardian angel.
Do they see the entity?
No, they sense it. I mean, sometimes there's a visual, but usually it's just a sensed presence. And if you haven't had that, which I haven't, it's really hard to picture what that actually feels like.
And do you hear them? Do people say they hear?
Sometimes they hear them. And in fact, not only do they hear them, but the presence provides instructional advice. You know, turn left here, or you've got to keep going, or there's a boulder ahead. And the other thing is that sometimes these kinds of third man presences are also deceased relatives. So I've talked to people, for instance, who were driving along a highway, and then they suddenly heard their father, who was dead, the voice of their father behind them saying, slow down around that curve, and they slow down, and then, you know, a truck comes barreling along, that kind of thing. So all of these categories are kind of merging into one another a bit.
So it can be somebody, this third man, can be somebody that we know, or it can be somebody that we don't know. Is that correct?
That we can't identify.
Yeah, that they can't identify. Right. Yeah, exactly. They may well know them, but they don't know that they know them. Yeah. And they're there generally to do what? To save them from some catastrophic thing? Or is that basically usually what they're there for?
It seems to be. I mean, it's almost like more of a kind of a providing them with a sense of you're not alone, you know. So, I mean, this has happened to astronauts as well. And it's, you know, so with when you're in situations of extreme isolation. So it's also happened to prisoners of war. And also on the battlefield, actually, in World War I and World War II. So it's almost as if, you know, in our private terrors, in our personal struggles, the universe is saying, you know, you're not alone. There's somebody here who's got your back.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the story of the events during the Constitutional Convention back in 1787? I read about this a while ago, and I found it very, very interesting, where an unidentified man suddenly appeared and offered advice when the Founding Fathers were struggling with some words, or trying to figure out some concept, and then all of a sudden he was gone. nobody ever knew who he was.
Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I've wondered about that for a long time, and you know, and then when I was reading your book about the third man, all of a sudden it dawned on me that, you know, I wonder if that has anything to do with it or not.
That's interesting.
But it really is interesting. So you wonder, you know, if clearly, and you give a number of interesting examples in the book about, you know, various things, and most of them appear to be when people, and it's almost like they're in a death situation, but they're not supposed to die yet. So somebody like a guardian angel or somebody comes down to get them through that because they have more life left that they're supposed to live. But other times, you know, it's just when there's something that needs to be done, and it's not life threatening, it's just, you know, something important needs to be done and they're struggling with it, so they get some help.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I like the one story. Why don't you tell the story about the third man in the time of war, where the guy was in the foxhole and he got the vision from.
Yeah. So this was in World War I, right? It's a soldier who, he later wrote a memoir. He was a journalist as well as a soldier. A memoir about this experience. He had been on the front somewhere, and he was sleeping in a bivvy, like in a little, whatever that is, military tent. And he suddenly felt hands shaking him awake. And he roused from sleep very reluctantly. And it was his brother, a fellow soldier in the war, who he hadn't seen in 2 years. They'd been on different parts of the front. And the brother was saying, you know, you got to get up. You've got to get up. You have to come out of the tent. And so he got up and he followed his brother. And they went down this trench line and then around a corner. And then his brother vanished, and he was baffled, but he was also exhausted, so he just kind of collapsed in that part of the trench. And then his bivvy was shattered to, you know, completely obliterated by a shell. And later he found out that his brother, in fact, had died much earlier in the war on another front. So that was a combination of a sort of, you know, third man and deceased relative kind of experience. And there were a lot of those in the war where people found themselves guided out of areas in no man's land or through crossfire areas and stuff like that. So, you know, a lot of the literature came out of the war experiences.
Do you believe we have pre-life planning, that we lay out our life ahead of time?
I have no idea.
Okay. See, I do. I think we lay out our life, and we have certain things we're trying to accomplish, and we have free will. So we, you know, we have these experiences, but and which are pre-planned by us as well as our guides. But we, how we react to those experiences is. You know what we do. That's the free will part. We can choose it, but we have certain things to do, and we have a certain amount of time to live that we're supposed to live. I mean, granted, you can change that. You can commit suicide. You have options, but there are other things that, you know, it says, hey, you know, we want you to live for so and so long because you have certain things you want to do, and it's like. These third man is like somebody coming down and saying, okay, you know, you got yourself in a jam here, but we need you to live longer and to do things, and they're stepping in to help out, and then they disappear. It just kind of fits into my belief system anyway.
That's interesting. And why do you have that belief system? Where does that come from?
There's been an awful lot of, well, not an awful lot. There has been some really interesting research done, mostly through psychics and mediums, that have been able to look into people's lives and connect with the spirit world and the spirit guides, and indeed and connect with people's souls. We have a personality and we have a soul. And our personality is a small aspect of our soul, if you will. And that, so our soul knows a great deal more and is always with us than we do as the personality, but the personality is here to experience things. And some of these mediums have been able to get, you know, contact these various spirit guides as, and as angels, if you will, and talk about pre-life planning. And it's amazing what some of the things they've found. The information is available. In fact, in a couple of months, I hope to have one of the guys that done a lot of research on that, Bob Schwartz.
Do you know Dr. Julie Beischel?
I don't.
She is a scientist with a double PhD in pharmacology and toxicology who does clinical trials, not clinical trials, but like the methodology that's used in like double blind drug trials. She yeah. uses that methodology to study mediums in Arizona.
Oh, okay.
And she has screened, at this point, she's found about 12 mediums who are able to obtain information like statistically above chance in terms of all the ways in which she's blinded them. So yeah. she's doing like really solid scientific analysis of mediumship.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely believe that some people are able to do that at will. Obviously there's charlatans out there, but you know, there's charlatans that don't know how to fix your car that will tell you they do.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I know that's the thing. It's very frustrating when you hear in the mainstream media, and they'll throw whole categories of people out the window because on the basis that they must be con artists. And you're right, like you could make that charge in any profession or in any area. So, you know, it's there's a bigotry at work in there.
Yeah, exactly. Shared perception. Tell me about shared perception.
You mean like shared,
where two people might be in a car accident, if you will, and one of them will die and the other one will go on the journey towards the spiritual world with them for a short period, but they'll come back. The one that lives comes back, and they both, you know, end up, you know, the person that comes back is perceiving the experience, and then when they return, they find that the other one, who they thought was going with them, you know, had died.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon that people report. And in fact, I recently interviewed a fellow journalist who'd had this experience with her grandfather, and you know, she had never heard of it. And so when it happened to her, she thought she'd gone insane. And a lot of people are, you know, because they don't know about it, it's not very commonly discussed. It can be very frightening as an experience because you don't understand what's going on. But where you sort of, somehow your consciousness gets entangled. And so when the person dies and essentially goes out of their body, you either witness them doing it or you kind of join them in a perception of light, of a shift in the geometry of the room, an awareness of music, an awareness of color. You know, it can be quite a complex and subtle array of subjective experiences. And then the person who dies, you know, you come back into the room on your own. But I think that's something that, you know, it's hard to say how many people that has occurred to and why it would occur to some people and not others. There's a lot of research that still needs to be done on that subject.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes you think of quantum mechanics in entangled particles, you know?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's entangled consciousness.
NDEs. You had some interesting thoughts on NDEs in the book. You talk about a professor at the University of Virginia, and the University of Virginia has done some pretty interesting stuff in NDEs and reincarnation and you know, with Ian Stevenson and such.
Yeah.
But you talk about Bruce Grayson, who came up with a list of items that he would judge an NDE or the depth of the experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this was an attempt by the psychiatrist Bruce Grayson to kind of dig down into you know, what do we mean by a near-death experience? What's involved in it? How do you talk about it as different than, you know, just having a kind of dream toward the end of life or even a hallucination? So he came up with something called the Grayson scale. And the more items you could check off that scale, the more likely it was that you'd had a kind of full-blown NDE. And, probably one of the most common items on that scale is this encounter with a kind of sentient light. And so when you hear about NDEs in sort of mainstream media, they'll tend to make a reference to seeing the light as if it were some kind of, you know, visual. And they've even come up with this idea that, you know, that's just, you know, your vision narrowing as you lose brain cells toward the end of, but it's not that. It's not about the vision. It's actually an encounter with a light that's also love, that's also knowledge, that, kind of envelops you almost like an ocean. So it's a completely novel subjective experience that really is kind of entering into a spiritual realm. And I think that's why when people have those kinds of near-death experiences, they're completely at a loss of words. There's no vocabulary for what they're experiencing. There's nothing in our world that resembles that powerful sentient light.
Yeah. Some of the he had, I think it was 13 different items that he evaluated the NDEs on, and there were, you know, as you mentioned, the feeling of peace and surrounded by light, and he had a feeling of cosmic unity. And I guess if you haven't gone through that or some similar experience, or probably similar experiences, it's hard to explain what that is. But that seems to be one of them: entering another realm, encountering other beings, life reviews. He had a number of them. I think it's a pretty clever way to start looking at these things, because it's amazing how similar they are.
Yeah.
Throughout cultures,
yeah,
and throughout time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've got descriptions from like the 10th century of exactly the same thing. And in fact, you know, when I looked at that and looked at those core elements of the experience, then I got interested in, when you go back and you look at all the different scriptural traditions, whether it's Christian or it's Buddhist or Muslim, what's interesting is they all talk about this light. That light is a reference point in virtually every religious writing. So you know, quite apart from the doctrines and the creeds, the actual subjective experience of what it means to be religious kind of overlays with the NDE in an interesting way.
Yeah. And then when people come back, they say things like time doesn't exist. And their perspective seems to be perspective of themselves and others seems to have changed dramatically.
Yeah, it really has changed dramatically, and that takes place over many years. So it's not like a temporary thing; they get fundamentally changed.
Yeah. And the other thing I thought was interesting is children. When it happens to children, they end up recognizing the deceased, and they recognize them by, you know, people that they've never met, but they recognize them, they go through old pictures, old family albums, and they say, oh yeah, I met so-and-so.
Yeah. And
that's rather fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. The whole thing is fascinating. And the thing that's interesting to me about the idea of being outside of time is that once you hear people who've had NDEs talk about that, then you think about the kinds of experiences like the grief hallucination. And it's like, well, why would I have seen, you know, my dead father 2 years after he died? And then, but from his perspective, if he's out of time, you know, it could have been like the day after he died. So you can't really use a kind of linear measure to try to understand, you know, the kinds of encounters that we have. I mean, it's out of time and space, right? So I found talking to people who had NDEs very helpful as a kind of guide to understanding our experiences at this end of you know, the survival of consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever run across anybody that had multiple NDEs?
Yeah. It seems to be quite common. So I would say that one thing that happens is when people have their first NDE, it seems to kind of shift the permeability of their consciousness in some way. So they become more psychic, for instance, a lot of them, or all of a sudden psychic, so that, that you know, they become aware of other people's medical conditions and other people's emotional states. It's like it hypersensitizes them for some reason. And then they can be more prone to further future NDEs, or it seems to be that way. There's that pattern.
You know, that and it would seem to me that an NDE is a purposeful event that your spirit guides or whatever create to help you get back on the right path. I mean, I don't know that this is true. It just seems to me that it would be. And it just seems that multiple NDEs would be, in general, unnecessary. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, what I know about why there's an NDE is almost nothing. But it just seems to me that it would be unusual to go back and, you know, and do it again. Like, you know, when you go back into the spirit world and they say, hey, this is what you got to do, you'd think they'd only have to give you guidance once, but, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one example of that, this guy I interviewed, the engineer David Bennett, he drowned in California while he was working on a naval vessel. And then, you know, had this really, really extensive NDE and realized that he had to go on a more spiritual path, but he resisted it. He completely resisted what he'd learned for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And so then he went back into an NDE state when he was in Arizona. I mean, not on purpose, but he wound up back in it. So it was almost as if, you know, the universe was saying, like, listen, like, we just told you 12 years ago.
Exactly.
And so he was like, okay. And then since then, he's completely changed his life.
Well, you know, I guess that's no different in normal life, right? I mean, how many times do we get beat on the head until we finally get it?
Yeah.
You mentioned something in your book in regards to the out-of-body experience. It's called acute dying experience.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, this is a body of research out of psychology where they've kind of figured out that contrary to what you would think, when somebody falls, like if they fall off of a bridge or they are there in an airplane that's going to crash, or some kind of like very sudden kind of approach to death that doesn't involve them physically. So they're not physically injured yet, but they're anticipating almost certain death. They actually go into a state of real peacefulness and serenity. So, whether it's to protect themselves or it's, you know, however you want to look at it, the net effect is that it's much more upsetting and frightening for us to witness somebody, let's say, fall off a building than it is for them to experience it. They tend to go kind of out of body and into a very serene state. And it has nothing to do with them being physically injured. It's almost like a reaction to terror.
That's interesting. I wonder if anybody did any research on, when Sully put that plane in the New York River. There were a lot of people that must have thought, well, this is about it.
Yeah, that's right. So I interviewed one woman who was in a plane crash, and that's when she had this experience. So, okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, science can only answer the questions that you ask. And so since so many people in science are not interested in these questions, they don't ask them.
Why do you think science struggles with this so much?
I think it came out, it came out of a kind of fork in the road happened in the late 19th century where Darwin and his, the other guy who invented the theory of natural selection, Wallace Russell, or I forget his, Alfred Wallace Russell or Alfred Russell Wallace, anyway, that guy.
Yeah, it was Wallace was the last name, I think.
Yeah. So Wallace and Darwin, they both come up with the idea of natural selection, but Darwin takes it one step further and says it proves that God doesn't exist and that we are all just purely physical beings. Wallace, however, said that's not the case. There can be natural selection as well as eternal consciousness. So he kind of had a position that's actually what the Vatican says now, right? And then the two of them staked out these different territories and then went into a pitch battle with various scientists aligning on each side. And the Darwin side was really like remarkably vicious, actually, in slandering the other side. And we've sort of never really come out of that fight. So it's almost as if to say that there's any kind of psychic behavior or telepathy or precognition or is somehow to say that the church was right all along. It's like it's gotten all muddled and confused about what it is. Like, who cares if telepathy exists? Like, why is that so threatening to science? It just doesn't make any rational sense for it to be so threatening, but it is.
Yeah, it is threatening. You know, the science and religion kind of divvied it up probably, what, 300-400 years ago when religion was getting so much wrong in the physical world. So they finally acknowledged that, okay, we'll let you scientists, worry about the physical world and we'll worry about the spiritual world. And of course they had the power and the might at the time. So the scientists kind of went along with it and it just kind of seems to have built from there.
Yeah.
But if you look at a lot of these scientists, they have a lot of them individually, you know, maybe not the mainstream, but a lot of the major scientists, they have very spiritual views. They.
Yeah, there was an interesting book that came out a while ago by a sociologist that showed that the number of scientists that are in the closet about their spirituality. So, you know, she went and did like an anonymous survey and like far greater number of scientists had spiritual beliefs, but they weren't telling their colleagues. They didn't want anyone to know.
Yeah, it's one of those things that there's a stigma against it.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, and a lot of people, especially if you look at what science really is, a lot of science is in the academic community. And a lot of the guys have built their reputation. The people that are running the departments have built their reputation on a certain perspective, if you will. And for them to all of a sudden change is not an easy thing. And when somebody comes along with a new concept. I forget who it was. One of the founders of quantum mechanics was asked in his later years when he was finally able to convince people that quantum mechanics is right. And he said, I never convinced anybody. He said the old people just died and the young people grabbed it and went along with it.
I think that's right. It literally shifts by generation.
Yeah, it really does. People come in and they have different views and they start looking at it differently. But, you know, there's an awful lot of really good science taking place at places like, you know, places like University of Virginia and Princeton and Stanford and a number of places where, you know, you look at what they've come up with and you say, you know, this is hard to refute.
Yep.
I think it's changing, and I think more and more people are beginning to look at it and say, hey, the world is not as it's being presented to us, and you start looking at the data, and you've done a really good job in taking a piece of this data and saying, hey, look at this, you know, this is, you know, you got to deal with it. And I think that's probably the biggest problem that I have with science is that they're too many of them are willing to say, well, it doesn't make any difference because it's not repeatable. Well,
yeah,
it is repeatable, just maybe not that particular instance.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think, So what are you doing? Are you planning on doing any more books in this area? Are you researching anything in this area?
Well, I started to home in on that phenomenon of becoming aware of death at a distance. And I've been doing some research around that and looking at there's some really interesting patterns in that. So I did
talk about that a little bit. What's that? Death at a distance.
So that's what the Scottish call second sight.
The second sight. Okay.
Yeah, because when my book came out, a lot of people got in touch with me from around the world saying that particular thing was the thing that had happened to them. So, you know, what the night that my mother died, I saw her at the end of my bed, or, you know, that kind of thing. It was really common as the thing that people got back to me about, more so than anything else in my book. So I got curious about that. And I looked at the research going back to the late 19th century and in all kinds of different parts of the world as well, to see what the patterns were in that phenomenon. And it seems that it's more likely, if that happens to you, it's more likely that it's going to be an older relative that you become aware of dying, not a child, for instance. In all different parts of the world, this is true. And it's also going to be more likely a sudden death or a violent death, disproportionately. And so why is that? You know, what does that say about the matrix, you know, of our connection with through consciousness with other people? And so I'm hoping to collaborate with some scientists and do some research around that.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing you mentioned in your book was the mirage effect.
Yeah, I forget. What did I say?
I don't remember. And I wrote it down because I wanted to ask you about it, and I couldn't remember what it meant.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? How about dreams? You think dreams are important?
They seem to be, and actually, that's quite a bit of research that's being done in hospice is around the dreams of the dying, and you know, sort of, I don't know if you want to call them precognitive dreams, but it seems as if our ability to become attuned to our kind of shared consciousness or collective consciousness is heightened in that relaxed and open state of the dreaming mind. So a lot of a lot of really kind of important signals come to us in that way through dreams, including this awareness of death at a distance. It's the most common way is suddenly having an extremely vivid dream about the person who's died.
I think that dreams are fairly important. Not everyone. And if you dream, you have to go to the bathroom. Generally, we all know what that's about. But there are dreams that information does come through.
How do people get a hold of your book?
Hello? I think you're pixelating. Your voice is pixelating.
Okay. The question was, how do people get a hold of you? How do they find you?
Oh, through my website, Pearson's Post.
Pearson's Post. Okay. And your books are available on Amazon. And it's under Patricia Pearson.
Yeah, P-E-A-R-S-O-N.
Yep. Okay. Well, Patricia, thank you very much. You've been a great guest. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thanks so much for thinking of me, David.
Take care.
Bye.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.